Secure your digital world in physical form with IM8bit. For over 15 years, IM8bit has been crafting premium expansions of the industry's best games, from pioneering community experiences for Epic's Fortnite World Cup to bringing over 100 award-winning soundtracks from breakout hits like Untitled Goose Game and Disco Elysium to vinyl, and bringing the Ori sequel to Switch. Their passion for artistry and gaming fuels them, whether they're interpreting beloved brands from a new point of view or extending the mythology of another game, perhaps one you're developing. What's the IM8bit difference? Their collectibles are premium, but for IM8bit, they're personal too. See for yourself at im8bit.com.
Hi, this is Austin Wintery, and this is the Game Maker's Notebook. Today, I am chatting with the great Mark Mothersbaugh. He is, of course, originally quite well known for the band Devo, and then he became quite well known for extensive work in animation, most notably TV shows like Rugrats, and then later movies like The Lego Movie. But he's also quite well known for some superb work in video games, and most recently, of course, Insomniac's new Ratchet & Clank. So we talk all about his experiences with COVID, with his work on this game, life in general, having adopted kids. It was a remarkable conversation, and also quite fun for me selfishly, because unlike most of these, this was the first time we'd ever met, and we really didn't know very much about each other at all. And so it was kind of an earnest first impressions kind of conversation. So I loved it. He's a truly superb musician and composer, and I hope you enjoy hearing what we talked about.
Welcome to the Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Mark Mothersbaugh, very nice to meet you. It is novel to be meeting you for the first time. Normally, I have a long history with the folks that I do this with, but in a way, it feels like I've met you because I've been an admirer of your work for quite a long time. But now I get to put thoughts and ideas and quips with a body of work. So good morning to you.
Okay, awesome.
One thing I wanted to ask just straight out of the gate, I heard you mention it just a moment ago, but I remember reading about it a year and change ago. You know, normally we've tried to do these recordings in person, but COVID forced a kind of remote recording workflow. And I had read that you had a horrendous bout with it. So I just kind of wanted to ask how you're doing, and if you're if you are feeling in good health, and just kind of make sure that you're okay. Cause it sounds like you had a really horrendous, just God awful experience.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that. Thanks for being interested in my health. Cause I am an old guy, you know, but I got curious, you know, I was curious to see what it was going to be like. And I got a nasty case of it. It was like, I was working on a couple different projects at once, including Ratchet and Clank and a feature film. And I just thought I was getting tired. I was by myself for about a week, and you know, nobody was in the studio with me, so I was here all alone. And every day, I just thought, "Wow, I'm really." If I would have had even a slight idea that I could have possibly have had COVID, I would have not had the same situation I did. But I ended up going in, like, by the time I got to ICM, they just threw me on a ventilator. And it was interesting, because how old are you?
I'm 37.
Yeah. I'm 71, which is a lot older than 37. And in my mind,
it's all a matter of months.
I'm saying, you know, like when I was 69 and when I was 70, in my mind, I was in my late 40s, early 50s. And I went into a hospital to an ICU and came out 20 days later feeling like I was 90. It was really bizarre. It was kind of, you know, like if you're I have some issues that are open that I don't want to, I'm not really, my time isn't up yet. I have things I have to do. So it's like,
I endorse that sentiment heartily.
So, you know, it's like, but it was shocking to all of a sudden go from feeling like I'm 50 to feeling like I'm 90. And so that was an amazing life experience that,
have you been able to swing back around to your inner 50-year-old, in the time since?
I'm trying to get there. I'm 70 now. So I'm trying to get back down to 50 or so. I have a couple things that are taking time to heal. But I think the COVID related stuff is fine. I think I'm not the person that has the long-term COVID things that they talk about. Instead, I got, I had the most amazing delusions while I was in there. And some of that I've decided to hold on to on purpose because I have a whole album of Devo music that's when I can, you know, put the time into it to do it, I have the whole lyrics and everything about it already inside my
head. Born of that experience, you mean?
Born of that experience. Yeah, it happened while I was in ICU.
Like fever dream kind of musical inspiration. Wow.
It was pretty amazing. I also had like super creepy dreams too. So, and it's somewhere in there, I'm told that like within a, you know, while I was on a ventilator, I had reached up and pulled the tubes out of my body. And so they came in and had a number of people holding me down while they jammed it back in. And in the process, one of my eyeballs exploded inside. So I can't see yet out of my right eye. I'm still
at all
blind in my right eye at all. And I can't sing all Devo songs yet. Because I wrote all these songs when I was 22 to 27, most of the songs that we're supposed to be playing in September. Think about that. That's incredible. So I'm going to all different kinds of rehab people. I'm going to, you know, like,
is it about strength and endurance or is it, ability to hold pitch or what's kind of, forgive these, I'll interpret your answering as acceptance, but if I'm getting intrusive, please just shut me up.
Yeah. I lost the top part of my register and I remember about 14 years. Have you ever seen what your vocal cords look like?
Not mine, but I've certainly seen what a vocal cord looks like.
I was never curious about it, and I never considered myself a singer. All the years I was with Devo, I never took vocal training or anything. I was just ranting, and I was just a young guy in a basement with the other guys, and nobody else could hold an instrument and play it and sing at the same time. So I shockingly became the singer for the band, which I had no intention of originally. I hadn't even considered it. And then I ended up liking it. but you know, it's like, I saw, like somewhere about 15 years ago, we were playing some show and, we were in some big auditorium in Denver. And after some, I was coughing and drinking a cup of tea. And, the guy who was putting on the show said, "Hey, we got a throat doctor on call. If you want to use him." I go, "Oh no, it's just, you know, it's just from singing every, you know, I'm shouting half the song." So, you know, and he said, "Well, just go see this guy. It's free." So I went and saw this guy. And while we're talking, he's putting like something like some Novocaine or cocaine or something on my nostril. And then he runs a camera up my nose. And I saw my vocal cords for the first time, which are, they're gross. You know, your vocal cords are disgusting. It looks like a slimy, wet, plucked turkey with this shape in the middle of it that goes like this when you're talking.
Right.
So I was like, "Oh my God, I got to do that for a video. That'd be a great Devo video. If I just the whole time I'm singing, it's, you're seeing." So I know what it looked like, and it was perfectly symmetrical. And he diagnosed me with having acid reflux. And so when I changed my diet, I was like, I wish I would have known about this 25 years ago. I could have got rid of it.
You didn't have manifest it, because I've actually had acid reflux my whole life and had to do the camera down the throat as well as part of that. And they, but it didn't take, I mean, I'm not a singer. Well, I suppose, according to you, neither are you, but you far more pedigreed as a singer than I am. It wouldn't even just lying down after a heavy meal, I would feel the symptoms of it. So you're saying that it was never, you've not been dogged by the symptoms.
Well,
outside of singing,
it for me, it's diet. That's what gives me acid reflux. So I know what kind of things I can change and it will go away. And I didn't know that for 25 years. And
I'm just impressed that there weren't other, like if you ate those things, you didn't basically feel like crap, even if you weren't singing, or maybe you did and just shrugged it off.
I put A and B together. No.
Yeah. Got it. Right. Yeah.
All that time, I just thought, well, I'm not a singer for real. You know, I don't know. Who would you call a singer? That Michael McDonald or somebody, you know, or
right.
Patti LaBelle, or I'm just throwing, you know, just Stevie Wonder. Those people really can sing and have incredible vocal range and have.
You're more in the Randy Newman end of the spectrum by your own.
I'm more like line up a bunch of punk bands from the 70s and 80s, and I'm in that. You know, back before people like Green Day turned punk music, and the vocals started sounding like barbershop quartets and stuff.
Yeah.
Before that, it was like there was like a lot of ranting and shouting. You know, like.
Sure.
More in the Johnny Rotten,
yeah,
things, but I never put it together. But so I know what it looks like. I know what my vocal cords when they're perfect, how symmetrical they look, and they look great. Well, about 5 months ago, I was singing some demos for some project I'm working on, and I realized I couldn't sing the higher notes. And I said, "Whoa, wait a minute, we're signed on to sing songs." In September, that's a long ways away. But so I tried singing Devo songs. I realized I couldn't sing like this register that I usually sing it in. So I've been doing every kind of therapy and rehab. I can, anybody that has a good idea, I try it out. And I'm working on it, and we'll see what happens when it comes September, whether the shows are canceled or if we're going to go through with it. I'm hoping we go through with it.
Well, for the record, just putting it out there, I once went to a show. I'm trying to remember who it was, but I once went and saw a concert with kind of a singer-songwriter who was sick and decided not to cancel. She had like a cold. It wasn't anything severe, but her voice was definitely. And so she got up at the beginning and said to the audience, you know, just so you know, I didn't want to cancel because this was, I think, at the Greek. So it's, you know, fairly substantial size audience to cancel on. She could have, but it said, I'm just going to do my best. Bear with me. And she cracked notes and she missed notes the whole time. And the audience was like, we have your back. You know, you're human. It was actually one of the most charming things I ever saw in concert because the audience just cheered her. Every time she struggled, the audience just gave her nothing but love. And I think especially knowing the catalyst, like people are going to be so, it's going to be so cathartic to even be at a concert around people, at least that's been my attitude, that I think if you were to say like, hey, just so you know, this is where I'm at, I suspect you'll get nothing but love. But far be it for me to offer concert advice to you.
Well, it'll be a little bit different in the sense that whoever you're talking about, they were probably the headliner. On some of these, we're just like, it's like a, like one of the shows, it's basically Morrissey. It's a festival, but it's his show, you know, so we're like third or fourth on the roster. So there'll be people there that are like, that'll be like looking at their watch maybe if I do that. So I'm really trying to get it back together before then. We'll see what happens.
Well, your instincts are far more chiseled than mine in this way, but I'm all that said, I'm glad to hear that non-trivial thing to be contending with, notwithstanding, it's great to hear that you are, for all intents and purposes, in good health and working your way back to your natural state. Is
thanks. So other than that, and that's it. That's the only thing. And so,
yeah, that's good.
I'm quite honest. Yeah, I don't know if you need this in your cast or not, but your podcast. But my daughter, I have two daughters, and they're adopted. And one of them, we adopted her specifically because she was on an emergency list because they said she was going blind. And I'm like, my wife said, we gotta adopt this little girl. I go, oh, but how do we deal with a blind? Because you've had problems with your eyesight all your life. You were born legally blind, and you, glasses is the only thing that kept you so you could see. So you know what it's like to be blind, and she needs help. And I was like, oh, well, anyhow, so it's been arrested in one eye, and she still sees pretty good out of it. And the other one, unfortunately, by the time we were able to adopt her, she was already five, and she had lost sight in one eye. And, you know, they were just warning that she was going to fall out of the adoption thing because nobody wanted her.
Oh, wow.
Well, we want her. So we got her. And so, like, when I came back home after COVID, and she watched me pour coffee on a countertop because I missed the glass, and she was like, Dad, let me show you how you do it. Because she's blind in one eye.
And
she,
that is amazing.
She took her little finger and went like this and touched the side of the glass and then poured the liquid in. And I'm like, thank you for that.
How old is she now?
She's 19, and she, ironically, she got a partial scholarship at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. So she's an artist and with you know, working on one eye. And it's incredible. You know, if her and I were both right now to do a drawing or a painting of you, mine would quite possibly look like you, and hers would look like a photograph. That's the crazy thing about it.
I love that. That's like Beethoven, you know, just as the ears go, the music somehow gets better.
I hope you're not talking about the movie Beethoven with the big shaggy dog.
I am. Yeah, no, I'm speaking solely of Gary Oldman. That's amazing. I love hearing that. That's a really, like, I don't know. It sounds very hackneyed to say, but just there's a real thirst for silver lining kind of COVID stories. Yeah. And that's a good one.
Well, you know, it's like, and my wife and I were both panicking because our other daughter, she's a ballerina. She was going to leave home this year too. And both of them got stuck in the house with us for a whole year. And we are so selfish that we loved it the whole time.
Yeah. I've had other friends with kids about that age say the same thing. And I don't have kids of my own, but that's, I totally get it.
You know, I wasn't going to have kids because early on, like when I was 19, I think, I read this book called The Population Bomb.
Yeah, I know the book. Yeah, Ehrlich, I think is his name.
And it basically predicted by the year 2050, a virus could possibly wipe out the human population. And it was because of overpopulation of the planet with humans. It was said, just do the math. There's going to be too many humans to be supported by this planet. And he said the only other thing that could happen other than that is possibly some sort of a nuclear annihilation, which now, based on the last 5 or 6 years in the world, I just feel like the world could be crazy enough that somebody somewhere, you know, in Korea or even in the U.S., who knows, one crazy crackpot could say, I'm taking everybody out.
You know, so you were like an anti-natalist before it was a fashionable concept.
I was for responsible reproduction, and which meant that people had to choose not to have kids for the benefit of humanity. And
adopting seems like the kind of the perfect compromise. Then it would seem.
That's what my wife said. She's a very good negotiator, and she's the one.
This is Anita Greenspan, if I understand correctly. I suppose. Putting two and two together there, it would make total sense that the negotiations don't just, they extend to all aspects of life.
Right. So it's great when she's pointed the other way for you.
Yeah, exactly. That's too funny.
or watch out. But you know, it turned out to be something that changed my life in an amazing way. And it made me have more empathy for people that are like, I used to just always just kind of get a irritated cringe when people would go, oh, I really want to have kids, or I can't wait to have 100 children, you know, and you'd go, yeah, great. You're going to accelerate the pace of the destruction of planet Earth, you know, is how I thought of it. But it's like now I totally, after I, when I first saw my first child, and I was kind of thinking, up until that moment, I was thinking, my wife is crazy. She's insane. Why is she doing this? Why are we in China? And then I saw this little girl that I'd been looking at pictures of for like 8 months, 10 months, ever since she was abandoned and then put up for adoption. And it took, the red tape took forever. But
she's from China, you said. Yeah, I can't even imagine what the red tape is like then.
Well, you know, and also they, you know, at that time they were treating girls like they were just.
Yeah, trash.
Yeah, they didn't want them. Yeah, everybody wanted a boy. Now there's all these boys that are going to school together and like all trying to find the one girl in town they can date. But in the meantime, you know, it's like, I remember being there and we, you know, when I first saw her, it's like, I don't know, you've probably never taken acid, and I hope nobody that ever listens to this blog ever took LSD. But to me, it was like taking LSD. It was like this door opened in my head that I didn't even know I had. I'd closed it off in my early teen years. And I went, that's my baby. I'm a dad. And it was like this whole primordial thing, the whole connection to a child and to being a father and to, you know, being part of that whole thing. I was like, oh God, there's no way we'll ever be able to stop people from overpopulating the planet. This is such an amazing, this is such an amazing primordial feeling that I had never, you know, witnessed before, that I thought it'll just never happen. It's going to be some other method. So it's going to be a virus or nuclear warfare. One of those will take out.
Well, you've proven that so far, at least one of those can't hold you down. So I think if we put you to a kind of Bruce Banner test, we'll see if the other one can get you. But it's so far, your track record is looking pretty good.
Well, thanks.
Well, how does that, I'm curious.
Our Hulk.
yeah, exactly. That's been great. Go have a good rest of your day. I'm curious. I am curious, actually, and can happily use that as a segue, though, to talk about sort of music. And obviously, you know, one of the questions that I get asked a lot that you, I think, will have probably a far more profound insight in than I could potentially offer. In a way, I hate this question because it's become so generic, but when discussing the differences between films and games, but before we get into any of the kind of, you know, meat and potatoes, I'm curious how, as someone who was a professional musician and living the musician's life, for many years before you had kids, I'm curious if your thinking about music and the way that you write and the way that you think about it and the way you relate to music has changed as a result of that kind of primordial thing you're talking about. Do you feel music differently, or do you? I don't want to lead your answer down any path. So just open-endedly.
I do visual art every day, my whole life, and if you ask me, I feel like I'm equally a visual artist and a sonic artist, and they both complement each other, and one of them helps me solve problems with the other one, and vice versa. And so I have to say that it really dramatically affected my visual art to have kids, because I thought I was going to be a visual artist before I became before I thought I was going to be a musical artist. Because at seven, a teacher, it was the very end of second grade, and my teacher said, wait a minute, his face is 1 inch away from the paper when he's trying to write his name. And she'd been like, you know, like, disciplining me. She spanked me in front of the class for making smart ass comments. She said, Mark, would you read the numbers on the board? And I go, what's a board? And everybody laughed and I laughed with them. And then she goes, all right, get up here. And she swatted me. And I'm like, how do people know the right answer to that question? I have no idea how I'm getting it wrong, and they know the right things to say. And they sent me to an optometrist. There were five kids in my family, and this is not an uncommon thing for people to get, you know, like passed over or to get unnoticed that they have a visual impairment. But it was at the very end of second grade, and I was seven, and they examined my eyes, and they said, he's legally blind. He can't see the big E on an eye chart from 1 foot away. And to truth, I could see things in focus from 4 to 6 inches. And after that, they just turned into a fog. And I thought that's how it was for everybody. And I managed to walk to school every day for 2 years without getting squashed by a car. And, you know, I just followed the sidewalk. I just, you know, looked down and I could tell, you know, because it was like about 6 blocks to school. But it's like
something so wonderful about the innocence. Sorry to just interject, but I just love the innocence of a child that doesn't know better. It's kind of like if you've ever seen, I don't mean this to sound like a disparaging comparison, but it's like when you see a dog that's missing a leg, it doesn't sit there feeling bad about itself. It just learns to walk with 3 legs. And it sounds like you had that period as a real young kid of just making do without realizing that most people don't, this is not an issue for most people. And there's something that, I don't know, there's something very endearing about that.
It was kind of cool. I mean, I had this incredible moment in my life where I walked out of a doctor's office with a pair of glasses and I saw telephone poles with telephone wires. I'd never seen that in my life.
It was your first LSD trip in that moment.
It was incredible. It was like I saw birds flying. I'd never seen that, or clouds. I'd seen pictures of clouds. I saw the sun. I saw a roof on a house. I could never see that before. And I saw smoke coming out of chimneys. And it was like this, you know, it was like this intellectual, emotional overload that just made me feel so joyous about life, that all this stuff happened at one time. And so I was drawing the next day in school trees, because I'd only ever seen the part that I'd run into, you know, when I was my teacher, who had spanked me and made me wear a dunce cap, they did that in the 50s. They don't do that anymore. But back in the 50s, they'd make you wear a dunce cap if you to try and get you to behave. And she walked up behind me and she's looking at me drawing, and she says, you draw trees better than me. And it made me like, that night I dreamt I was going to be an artist. And so I'm
amazed how clear and formative this memory is. This is incredible.
It was really that. And then I just was positive I was going to be a visual artist up until I was 12. And then, you know, we had 5 kids, dogs, and a monkey at some, and flying squirrels and different animals at my house. It was crazy.
Where was this?
He was in Akron, Ohio, and my dad was to keep us like a little bit under control at dinner time. He had this little portable black and white TV, like a little 6-inch by 6-inch screen or something. And he'd put the TV on the dining room table, and then the kids would shut up and we'd watch Ed Sullivan while we were eating instead of, you know, like, you know, playing with our food and fighting with each other.
Right.
I just remember one night, you know, nothing special except Ed Sullivan goes, because I hated music. When I was 7, when I got my glasses, I started taking organ lessons. And I had this organ teacher, that Mrs. Fox, who sang out a tune, and she'd be singing along with me. I'd be playing this, you know, little home spinet organ in my family's house, 2-bedroom house. And I'd play really loud, so everybody had to endure it. And I'd be going, and you'd hear Mrs. Fox going, 77 Sunset Strip. And I made sure I played it slow and loud. So she'd sing really loud, out of tune. And
apparently
they just tried to just like huddle around a TV so they didn't have to hear. I just thought music was invented to torture me. about music is the worst thing. God, I can't believe I have to. My friends would be outside going past the window while I had to practice. They'd be going past the window with a football going, hi, you know, and they'd be off to play or something.
Well, so what rounded that corner then for you? Or maybe you still think that. Maybe you're in this like self-flagellation for the rest of your life, hating music all the way.
No, it changed 5 years later when I was 12, and we had the TV sitting on our set, and we're watching Ed Sullivan, and you know, he goes, and now some Liverpool, the Beatles. And there's this loud noise from the audience, you know, that's live in the room while they're filming. And the Beatles do, I Want to Hold Your Hand. And I'm like, oh my God, what kind of music is that? And it was like shocking, you know. And then they came back and did a second song, like She Loves You or something. And I was like, I was dumbfounded. I was like, oh my God, that's why I got tortured with music lessons my whole life, so I could do that. And so at 12, I was absolutely certain I was gonna do that, whatever that was. I wasn't even sure what that was. I know I went out and bought sheet music at Woolworth's for Hard Day's Night. You could buy the sheet music for it. And so I got the sheet music, and my friend Ronnie Wyszynski, who played accordion, came over, and the two of us would sit in my dining room where we had this little portable organ, and he'd be playing like this, and I'd be going, it's been a hot days, night, and after about a week or so, I realized I'd spent my whole life learning the wrong damn instrument. I should have learned drums or a guitar, and I'm like, oh my God, I've learned the wrong instrument. I've wasted my whole life playing this thing.
The existential crisis of a 12-year-old.
Yeah, I was totally depressed.
And well, I guess it's a good lucky happenstance then that watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, you didn't have Mrs. Fox singing over them, dragging them into the same orbit as these organ lessons. It's so funny how so many funny and tragic, but I will say fascinating how many stories that there are of these childhood music teachers that make it so brutally unengaging for young minds. And thank God for experiences like that to expose that it can be so much more.
It was just a whole different, yeah, it was.
Was your family supportive? Like, did your family, you know, get excited that you had this interest, or was there the kind of classic sort of cockeyed look at it?
They liked it that I was excited about something. My dad, I got to tell you, my dad, his parents were coal miners, and his goal was to become middle class. That's what he wanted, and he succeeded in that. But he did all these things to do it, and he was like this really positive guy. He was like always super positive, and he reminded me of later on. I met this guy Tim Leary, and I became close friends with Tim up until he died, and. They were both they were two of the most positive humans I ever met. And I thought of them in similar fashion, but my dad, like when I said I wanted to be in a band, everything was great about that until we found out, oh, that meant you have to get a portable electric organ, which was $340 or something. And, you know, with five kids, that was a lot of money. So that was the hard part. It took a while before I totally convinced him how serious I was about it. And then he thought, okay, we're going to get that thing. So he got it for me. And then I just took off on being in bands. I was like by about 13 or 14, I was in bands or something like that. Cause I had this keyboard and you know, it was it set me off on this direction. And then I was still kind of an artist. I was a visual artist the whole time.
Well, and that was what kind of set us down this path was when you said that your visual art really changed as a result of having kids. And I was curious to kind of unpack that just a little bit more. I do promise I am curious to learn about Ratchet and Clank, but this is just fantastic. So thanks for indulging my curiosity on all this other stuff. But in what ways did it really change, because you make it sound like it was a really kind of almost night and day shift and there more than in the music.
Because ironically, by the time I had my kids, I'd already done a couple decades worth of music for things like Pee Wee's Playhouse and, you know, Rugrats and Beakman's World.
Of course, yeah.
I'd done so many films and TV shows for kids. They convinced me. I got asked to be the art teacher on something called Yo Gabba Gabba. And I was looking at it and go, this is kind of a cool show. My wife is going, no, you don't need to be an actor on something. That's, you know, you just stick with the composing and stuff. But my kids, when they saw it, they loved the show so much that I was like, well, they don't know any of the stuff I've done. They don't even know about Pee Wee or Rugrats, really, because they started with Dora the Explorer. And
yeah, right.
Much later in mine. So I thought, well, I'm gonna freak them out. So I took a gig where I was the art teacher on a kid's show, and that was like kind of like mind blowing for them to like go, wait a minute, Dad's on TV, but he's sitting here with us. So I liked that. They would be, you know, amazed by that. But my visual art.
You made it sound like when you adopted these kids, there, because my question had been if there was a big shift you felt as a result of that kind of primal reaction to parenthood in your music, but you made it sound like it was less so there. And I guess this explains why, it just makes total sense. But visually something clicked or something changed.
Yeah. Because visually, my visual art, I started a long time ago because I was into like the Dadaists. I was impressed with this thing they did called mail art. And so I started creating cards and making them, each one an original card with art on it. And I used to put lyrics for potential Devo songs or for other things. I liked beatnik for some reason. So I liked beatnik poetry. I'd make like neo beatnik poetry. That cracked me up. Yeah, that idea. And I drew pictures that later became, you know, things that became Devo, you know, artifacts and Devo images. And I started saving the cards at a certain point, but I used to mail them out. And there were people that were into mail art back in the 60s and 70s. They still are. There's people still are that send me things and I exchange things with. I even did something recently with another artist. We did something about a year and a half ago called Postcards for Democracy, where we encouraged, because the post office was being threatened by our postmaster general at the time, or whatever he was, and our president at the time, we decided to support the post office and encourage people to send cards to each other during the pandemic, before the pandemic and during the pandemic. And we encouraged them to send them to us. I received, I don't even know how many thousands of cards here at Mutato Musica of amazing art that people did on cards. And so it's now in a gallery down in Florida right now, at the Robert Rauschenberg Gallery. There's a show up and there's these cards are up and they change every week because there's so many of them. But
that's amazing.
Yeah, but it's a kind of cool show. So I got in, I started saving them after a while. I started saving the cards and I put them in books. But my early stuff, how the kids influenced me, is I used to do these cards and people just got used to like, oh, there's the autistic guy from Devo that he comes to a meeting and he pulls out these cards and he's drawing pictures and writing things on them. And oftentimes I was just taking quotes from like record company executives that would say absurd things or things that, you know, that were like, if you were an artist, they were like outrageously, just foolish or rude to say.
Right. Yeah, sure.
And I kept all that stuff and then I'd show it to the Devo guys and they'd get a laugh out of it or not, you know, but I just tended to draw through the years, and I just always kept like it as a, it was kind of a diary, but also an image bank and all these other things. And a lot of them, I was like kind of curious about the differences between men and women early on. And a lot of my imagery was more in your face because nobody bothered to pay attention to look at them. You know, even people I date, the first couple of dates, they go, "Oh, what are you doing over there?" And I'd have a drawing I was doing, and they'd look, and then they go, "Oh, that's weird. Okay, thanks." And then after a couple of times, they just ignored it.
Yeah.
And so these were things that I could be doing in front of people and just put them in my pocket, and nobody paid attention the whole time. So it was kind of interesting to have, and it was something I didn't really. I mean, I would go through and I would, you know, like find images in there that would become used in Devo or become used in my art presentations I would do. If I found one that I thought was a strong image to use for a painting, I would then maybe turn it into a painting. And so, but when my kids came along, it's like I started mentally curating what I was doing a little more, and I was less vulgar.
Ah, I see.
And at odds with the things I did musically that were very pro kids and very, you know, pro that thing. It was like the visual art where there would be things that you could like, that I didn't want my kids to judge me by that. So
that makes total sense.
You can imagine that that's called becoming mature or something. You know? but they did, they really affected my art. As far as, I mean, they did, because of them, I became, you know, I was part of Yo Gabba Gabba. Also I tended to, after I had the children became part of my life, I tended to gravitate towards more animation projects. And although animation is like probably, you know, from a composer's point of view, it's like the most complicated music and the most complex music to write because of all the timing changes and you're so responsible. Music has played such a big part in bringing animated characters to life, you know, even in video games. You know, music has a lot to do with making you feel like those characters are living and breathing. Because, you know, it's like animation, it still isn't to the point where you can compete, you know, in a realistic way. You can't compete with looking out the window and you're looking at a tree that is like, as you're looking at it, it's growing and it's changing and the wind is making things move and there's little animals in it. And animation, as detailed as you get, you can't quite get that. So you have to, but you can resort to more fantastic things that go beyond the limitations. So that's your trade-off, and that's where you trade on your strengths. But music is especially like, and this relates to Ratchet and Clank too. It's like an orchestra. You're writing music for humans to perform in something where you're watching, you know, like a two and a half dimensional creatures, you know, like moving around on a screen. And to have, you know, like 80 people in a room or 90 people in a room, you know, just the fact that they're sitting there and as the countdown comes down, there's 80 or 90 people that are breathing, there's blood going through their veins, they're holding instruments and they're playing things. It's different than, I love synths, as you know, that's that was like my earliest inspirations were with synthesizers. But like for animation, you bring a lot to it with an orchestra because all these humans, they're all living and breathing, and that comes into the animation and gives it a life that on its own it doesn't have. And the easiest way to check that out is to just turn the sound off and watch the same animation with and without the sound, and you get that feeling. You can see what, and that's part of the reason why I love animation and working on animator projects, just because you get to bring a lot more to the game.
Well, yeah, one of the qualities that has defined your music as long as I've been familiar with it, particularly your scoring work, you know, which in my case, you know, it's probably well over 20 years worth of familiar, like what I would consider to be, you know, not shallow familiarity with your work. That urgency and that vitality has always marked it. I don't ever think of yours as the kind of music that's sort of ambient or is even sort of, it never sits still. And I know that part of that is just responding to the task at hand. And a lot of animation demands that even if you're going kicking and screaming into it, but it feels like that's just kind of an intrinsic part of your writing. And that's part of what makes you well suited to animation, as opposed to having to dig something out that maybe you're not interested in. And it was one of those that it was a really wonderful reminder and a total validation of what you said at the very beginning of this conversation, when you said, you know, I'm not done yet. I have things to say, because I have to tell you, playing Ratchet and Clank, it really felt like somebody who had things to say. I wasn't able to finish the whole game, but I was trying to, over the last week and change, get to the end, to see what secrets you had in store. It's always more fun to hear these things in context.
You just need another case of Red Bull and you'll
I know, exactly. Yeah. It's my damn intrusive other career that I have to deal with. But, the energy that you bring to it, there's a few things I want to call out, because what you just said really is apparent. I don't know what, something about maybe looking at the key art for the game, knowing what I do about the IP, like the franchise in general, and knowing your love of synths. I went in expecting something very inherently electronic. I didn't realize I had that expectation until I realized I was feeling surprised by how aggressively orchestral it actually is, and that the synths are like their flavor. And of course, there's moments where they step to the fore and really dominate the moment. But broadly speaking, it's like this hyperkinetic orchestral score where I thought, you know, holy hell, these musicians, they weren't bored. They weren't bored these days. I mean, there's a lot of vital energy to it, which is astounding that it works as well as it does, because the game is so visually overwhelming that you would think that the whole thing would add up to a kind of stimulus meltdown in the end, because it's just so much to contend with. But somehow it just kind of perfectly comes together. So I was curious how much of that is just the hardwired intuitions of a composer that, you know, this is not their first rodeo, versus a kind of more intellectual looking at it and saying, I think it ought to be pretty orchestral, you know, mostly here, some synth, like what, and bearing in mind that we'll get to in a minute, I know you had to kind of tag team some help, especially because of the COVID thing, but just broadly speaking, you know, do you just dive in? Do you have a kind of a process, or do you really try to analyze it and say, well, what does it need very particularly in this case?
You know, it's different every project for me. It's different, you know, and a lot of it has to do with who has created the visuals and the concept and the story. It's like they don't know it, but you know, at meetings they're being analyzed, and just everything they say is being. Like even the most inconsequential things you think about, like you're trying to determine early on what their vocabulary is for talking about music. And I'm totally at ease with someone who feels like they have no way to talk about it, to somebody that's talking totally abstract and talking about colors or you know, or just saying what they want it to feel like. I find that all interesting because I think partly because I was in a band with two sets of brothers and we always collaborated with each other. Mm. I feel really at ease as a collaborator. And it's even the way the company now is set up and why we're so successful is because we take advantage of everybody's, you know, thoughts and I love that. I love working that way. And I love, you know, that's what got me into working. That's why I felt so comfortable to work on things like TV and film and games and that kind of stuff, because it's kind of like I see those people that do the writing and the directors and the producers, I see them, we all want the same thing. And they're a little further along than me. When I get, by the time I get hired, they've already chosen a script. They've already worked on it. They might have filmed it already. They might have animation already in existence, mm-hmm. but they have all this stuff and we're coming in to help them, you know, fulfill a vision. That's how I choose the people I work with. It's like, Wataru, for instance, is like, he's a very empathetic guy to work with. And the way him and I have similar, we're totally different. I mean, he's even like got powers in a whole nother area where he's like a healer. I don't know if you know that about
him. I do. No. Yeah. He has led, like composer specific kind of guided meditation events to help people sort of center themselves and ground themselves. It's funny because he's got a real powerful command over music, but in interactions, he's very kind of almost Zen in a way, to not to sound reductive, but yeah, totally.
And that's the kind of stuff that made me say, hey, why don't we work together on this? You know,
how'd you two first meet?
I think he did some orchestration for me. It's like, you know, when you're doing a film, you're working so fast, you know, you get your music written and then they change things at the end and then you have to rechange them. And then you got like a week before you go in for, they finally sign off like a week before you have to record it with 98 people in a room somewhere in Abbey Road or in Sydney or something. And so you need a team. So you get a team to come in and they take what you've mocked up, you know, like with the best libraries you can find for pre-recorded orchestral sounds, you know, and you do as good as you can, but it doesn't sound like humans doing it yet. And so these people, they take that and transfer it into something where 98 different people can each have a sheet of music in front of them. And they play the right thing. And then we just have a little bit of modification on the stage and, you know, and it's finished. And so he started off in that area and then we talked and we became familiar with each other. And he just seemed to be such an easy person to work with that's how he got brought into this.
So how does the work kind of get divided in practice on a game like Ratchet and Clank, bearing in mind, obviously you mentioned before that there was a period where, when you were sick, you had to kind of hand things off based on sketchboards.
In reality, by the time I was sick, we were in the orchestral end of things and we were recording stuff. And so it was mostly just,
so
I was kind of like not able to talk, but everybody knew at that point what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to take this music that we've played and it's been signed off on and turn it into the orchestral version. And so like a lot of electronics was already done.
Yeah, you know, got it. So that means that you were mostly finished writing, I guess, well over a year ago then.
A lot of it was really, because I mean, there were still a few layers that they were still finishing and we had to get to later on. But you know, it was, the themes were all in place. Like, I mean, you know, like the Dr. Nefarious song, Wataru and another guy, Pete Siebert and me, we worked on that together. And so that was all well before, you know, I got sick. But then they, our team over at the production house, they hired and recorded singers from all over the world to sing on it in, you know, in multiple languages and stuff like that. So I didn't have anything to do with that. But my engineer did the final mix on all that. And he was already familiar with, we've done so many movies and together. We know how to work together. It's like you know, so.
Does that mean that you had to do, you were producing the orchestral sessions during the pandemic?
During the pandemic, we had a couple sessions where we had like half a room in Nashville where they spaced everybody out, and we'd have like 30, we'd have maybe just a string and a woodwind section in the room, or we'd have just the string section, and then we'd record all of them, and then we'd come back and record all the brass, and then we'd come back and record all the woodwinds. And so we still managed to work all last year. We were working. I mean, I also finished a couple films during the same time period that I had written earlier, and then we thought they'd be put on hold, but we were able to, at Abbey Road, we could, you know, do the same thing. It just takes three times as long to record it. So
yeah, exactly. Well, at least you weren't in the position of having to do what some other productions did where, you know, they literally recorded an entire orchestra by musicians tracking in their bedrooms one at a time, and you had to, you know.
Yeah, that's really.
That's just such a pain in the ass. And it's really not the same. The musicians aren't responding to each other, you know. It's really.
That was an experiment. And there, you know, some people, I know people that tried that and with different versions of success. You know, it's like if you're doing a quartet, or there's certain kind of music you can write where the players, where it's more like the Kraftwerk version of of orchestra, and you can do that. And there's some writers that actually even enjoy that, working that way. I think it was Howard Shore score Silence of the Lambs?
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard that's how he recorded that way back in the day, because he liked the idea of having that much control over every player more than he liked having them all meld together. Personally, for the song I write for animation, I love it when everybody's in the same room together. And most of the time, even when I'm doing games, which need to be recorded in separate, you know, segments, so that you can bring it in at different times, I like the whole orchestra to run through it together once, so they all have
exactly the same way. Totally agree.
Yeah, so that they all have an idea of what they're doing before they play it.
So does that mean? So obviously, one of the big differentiator, probably the most meaningful differentiator between film and game scoring, is exactly what you just alluded to: is the need for a kind of flexibility in the music, and in many cases, an overt non-linearity to the music, to be able to ebb and flow at the player's discretion. How did that sort of thing? You've obviously, you know, your work in games goes back all the way to The Sims, if not earlier, right?
Before that, I mean, I worked in on a Atari game where you had like four sounds. And one of them was called percussion, and you could change the pitch so it'd be.
Yeah, right.
You know, but you didn't have, and then you could have like something that was like a bass synth, and then a melody line that was something like a piano or something, and maybe one other sound, and that would be it. You were relegated to, like which now would be like a pinhead of space on a.
Yeah, exactly. Know. Yeah, a single atom. Yeah, so well then, that, knowing that you've really seen how it's all evolved, and one of the big evolutions within that has been the depth to which the music can be interactive. How much does that figure into your approach, and how much you're thinking? Because it felt, in the case of Ratchet and Clank, the music, it never really felt like it was mindlessly vamping. It really felt quite reactive. And so how much is that a ground up part of your process versus a retroactive, okay, how can we figure out how to kind of take this apart?
To me, games are maybe the most exciting, interesting format to work in, because one of the most fundamental things about it that's exciting to me is the way a player gets to hear the music is sort of like the way a composer creates the music.
Totally.
You know, because you hear it in pieces and it's building, and you're also, you know, you're also, it forces you to think of each piece of your music. It takes me back to when Devo had a 4-track tape recorder. We were using a little crummy TIAC 4-track quarter inch tape. And so I'd put drums on one mono channel. I put bass on one mono channel. I put a guitar on a mono channel. I put a synth on a mono channel. Then I'd mix it down, and then I'd put vocals and then maybe a lead guitar or a lead synth part over top of that. And everything had to be essential. You know, it's like each part, you didn't like nowadays there's this tendency, and it's gone on for a long time, but there's this tendency with multi-tracking for people to go, that bass sound isn't quite right. Well, play something else also on top of it. And so you like build it up with like maybe three or four or five or more bass sounds all together. And instead of like tearing everything down and making one essential sound, and gaming forces you into that because your song gets deconstructed. You know, it's like there's a reductive synthesis that takes you down to something, maybe legato, that's like building as, you know, maybe Homer's running around a food court. I had to do that once. And he picks up a sub sandwich from one place, and then he goes, and you add in a little bit of some strings that are going like at quarter notes now. You know, had these long bass notes, and you have quarter notes coming in, and then he goes and gets some fries from somewhere that's covered with chili or something, and then you add in, you know, some woodwinds doing some things on eighth notes, and then you get to the, and you have to think about that each one of these segments, you know, the first time a kid plays the game or anybody plays the game, they're going to hear each part of that music for a long time. They're going to hear it with just the bass legato notes for a long
time. It's like running through a Pro Tools session and just soloing the channels. No one outside of the creator used to have that ability, basically.
Yeah. And what's interesting is it's connected to the game player in a way that is amazing. That I could have seen, if this technology would have been available in the 60s, maybe pop music would have been different, to where people got used to the idea that they could add in things when they wanted to. Maybe somebody would have thought that was like an interesting way to take music you listen to every day, you know, that, because personally, it's when I discovered that some of my favorite albums were recorded binaurally, I ran back to listen to one channel at a time, and then like the Revolver album with the Beatles, and then you're listening and there's one channel that's got boom, 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 boom for Taxman or something, or Paperback Writer, you're listening to the bass and maybe a drum over on one side and the guitar, and then there's no vocals. Then you turn it to the other channel, and you're hearing John and Paul going, paperback. And then they go, Paperback Writer. You know, and you're like, oh, man, I love all those little clues. Yeah. That to me was like what later became Easter eggs in video games.
Yeah,
you know,
of course, yeah.
All these things that like made you feel like it was more than just this alien, amazing, you know, overpowering force that you were listening to. You were like then able to be inside it, and like Easter eggs are like similar in the sense that they give you clues as to how the developers and the writers were thinking when they were making the game, because they put that stuff in there sometimes as a, you know, just some of it feels like it's offhand and some of it feels like it's on purpose. Mm-hmm. And you can weigh it either way. You can listen to it and go, yeah, they were just having fun and they threw that in. Or this is actually helps you understand other things in the game.
I love that you, it's so funny because I so relate to specifically the idea of when you isolate things, you kind of hear things that weren't supposed to be at the forefront. I've always delighted when I hear page turns in orchestral recordings for that same reason, that it suddenly takes this disembodied abstract concept of the music and makes you realize that you're hearing human people who were at one time in a room, and it almost feels like time travel to me. It's like I've somehow gone back into that space where they were, because I hear those, you know, chair scrapes and those tactile reminders that they existed, you know?
Yeah, and instead of hearing like a perfect, like
sculpted,
string section all playing, coming on at the same time, you can hear, you know, like somebody was just a slight bit slower or just a little bit. And the same note played later on isn't like hitting a sample where it's the exact same sample every time. It's like they play it slightly different every time because they're breathing in, breathing out, you know, like there's stroking differently. And
do you think your appreciation of that sort of thing stems from playing in bands and just recognizing that there's a spontaneous energy? Like,
it's definitely related to playing in a band. I remember recording our second album in, I think it was a place called the Chateau, and it was with this guy, Ken Scott, an amazing producer who did, he worked with Beatles, he worked with Bowie, he worked with a lot of mostly English acts. But and that was why I wanted him to work with us, because we thought he'd bring something to it. And what he brought to it was unexpected. And in my feeling at the time, I felt like he totally destroyed the album, because the second album we wrote while we were performing live, and all the songs were meant to be heard live. Yet when he recorded us, he had it in his mind. He wanted to make everything really tight. And so we recorded the whole album one instrument at a time, where he'd put a click down, and then he had our drummer play to that. And then he had our bass player play to that. Then he had the guitar player play to that. And to me, the end result was not as satisfying as then the next, you know, the next month when we went out on tour and played the songs live, and they were so much more dynamic and so much more alive. He made it much more robotic than I think it should have been. And so I was really happy when we re-recorded a number of those songs live later on.
You kind of already hinted at this, but how do you reconcile that energy that comes from the live performance with the technical necessity to record a lot more like Ken Scott when doing especially a game, but even a film? You know, like, I mean, you've obviously worked with Marvel, like the stories of the sort of notorious amount of flexibility that's demanded for a dub requires huge amounts of stemming, or at least this is the reputation. And so you have to work that way to a degree. Like you said, you kind of rehearse the orchestra together, but games demand it for the sake of the interactivity. How do you reconcile those? How does it not feel overly robotic to you? Because it certainly doesn't sound like it to me. What's your pathway to kind of fixing that, squaring that circle?
Well, it's when you can anticipate what's going to happen. Like the thing with Ken Scott, if I would have known what was going to happen there, I could have, we could have like approached our performances a lot different than we did. We were kind of like, what are we doing? You know, what's this? This is kind of different than we expected. And we didn't, and it wasn't until after, you know, I heard the mixed album that I felt like, wow, we lost something.
Yeah.
And, but on the other hand, you know, it's like, I was lucky because I'm the one who archived everything in Devo. Nobody else paid attention to things. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, that there's five newspapers on that newsstand. We're in Paris and we're going to leave tomorrow. And so I'd go buy them all just because they all had pictures of us on it. And I'd say, okay, and I'd have to fill my suitcase and like, keep it. I was the archivist. So I'm the one who kept my 8-track tapes of every album we did up until they stopped doing 8-track tapes. And lucky for me, I had a girlfriend who didn't care about my archiving, and she had a car with an 8-track tape player, a crummy old Volvo that was had a crummy, and she pulled out the 8-track tape of Duty Now for the Future, which is our second album, and played it in her car. And I was at first like totally, that's my archive, you're not supposed to get in that. But then I listened to the album and I went, that's the best version of the album I've heard, because it was distorted and had a little bit of an effect of an 8-track on it.
Yeah, right.
And I was like,
warble.
That's the way it, that's so much more like what it was supposed to sound like. And so I was really happy that she had me listen to that. You know, she didn't do it on purpose. You know, she just was.
That's so funny.
But it worked. And the thing is, when you know how you're going to record something, when you know you're recording it in parts, like we do with games, you anticipate that in your writing. And
yeah, sure.
It gives you a chance to like, especially things that are like over top of that. Like after you do the orchestral instruments, you can put synths over top of that help bring in that organic feel and that, you know, to change it again. And the orchestra itself, the way you mix it, you can think about it that way when you're, as long as you know that's what you're doing, you know. It's when you don't know that you get tricked. But
yeah, it totally makes sense.
Yeah, the orchestra is really an amazing place to be, and especially in games. You know, it's like, I love, you think differently about music, don't you? Think about music different than, are you a writer?
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I score games as my, that's essentially all that I do. Score films. I've done quite a few independent films, but video game writing is my bread and butter.
Can I get your autograph?
We can trade then. But yeah, no, that's why I'm curious to learn about your relationship to the adaptivity. Cause that is my personal single biggest obsession with game music, is figuring out how can I make this music feel like the player has written it.
Yeah. You want every single piece when it comes in to be essential. Exactly. You know, you want every single piece to come on top of each other, and you can hear it with just those two pieces, or you can hear it with just those three pieces, or you can hear it with just those four levels, and you go, wow, it still works. And you know, and it's not like, cause you know how much time a player hears the music, you know, that's the same music. And you don't want them to go away saying, ah, God, I'm having nightmares of that.
Oh yeah.
That third level music. So you want each level to be as best as it can be.
Yeah. Player fatigue is one of those things that has always driven the front lines of interactive music precisely to avoid it, because you could just take a 3-minute track and loop it. And that's what games still to this day have leaned on overwhelmingly. But if you can find ways to not merely loop it, but to find ways to make it feel like the player, you know, is somehow driving it. I always think of it like I did a game where the score is really, really tightly interactive. And the game is also quite short. It's only about an hour and a half long. So for the last 5-6 years, we've been doing live shows where somebody on stage plays the game start to finish. And I'm conducting an orchestra, and I have all these hand signals so that I can recreate all the interactive music systems live on the fly with an orchestra. And the way we talk about I always say the player is like the top level conductor, and I'm like the middle management conductor between them and the musicians, because I'm basically just feeding the instructions that the player is giving me. But I'm using the toolkit of music that I've, like the Lego blocks that I've essentially built up in order to kind of string it together live. And so the goal is always, you know, how to do that with software. I don't mean producing it purely digitally, but I just mean, how are we stitching this all together so that the player feels like, holy shit, I basically made this music, so that it's not just, because everything you're saying is so true. What if we boil it down all the way down to just the violas? The viola part has to have the integrity to sustain that interest. But then if we add the trumpet on top of that, it's not just, oh, the trumpet part's independently interesting, but it's the player going, I have somehow birthed this trumpet part. And it made, when I hit the X and it made that trumpet come into existence, it's the trumpet's that much more interesting because it's my trumpet now. And yeah. And there's something really magical about it. It's wonderful to hear, because there's a lot of, inside of game, as someone who works overwhelmingly in games, I can tell you, I'm not afraid to clue you in. You're probably well aware of it, but there's always there can be a raised eyebrow at when composers in particular are perceived as, you know, so-called Hollywood composers who kind of get pulled into games for one reason or another. There is often the perception that they have no interest or understanding of how the interactive systems work, and they're being called in for some reason or another. And this has happened from time to time, and there are a few noteworthy exceptions to this. And I didn't really know, other than the fact that I know you've worked on a handful of games, I had no idea your interest until this conversation in these interactive systems. And it's wonderful to hear just how plugged in you are to that, because it's a lot to onboard. In my estimation, it does nothing short of pull at the threads of what makes music music, because we're used to thinking of, you play for the audience, here's the finished product. We're not used to lifting up the hood and saying, hey, you want to muck around with the ingredients. And I think a lot of musicians are kind of horrified at the prospect of that. So it's cool to hear that you're actually kind of engaged by it. You're actually activated by the idea of giving them that level of control.
Yeah. Yeah. First off, I'd love to see you conduct that orchestra. I'd like to see you being the traffic controller someday. Doing that to me is fascinating to think about.
Well, we can figure out, we can brainstorm a way to build a combined show that puts all this on stage together, if you like. I think that could be the mashup of the millennium. It would be quite fun.
Well, okay, now we're talking about something else. You want to go on tour with
I am all for just diving into the deep end and learning if I can swim. So just the answer is yes.
All right, so you can come join Devo on stage and we'll kind of like push them aside for a few minutes and do some things.
Yeah, well, if you it's like, I remember once my father was quite sick and he said, "Will you his hands were shaking. He was undergoing like chemo and he said, you know, would you mind shaving me?" And I said, "I've never shaved someone else's face before. This is actually a very terrifying," because I said, "I feel like if I slip, I kill you." Mm-hmm. And I said, "You know, so probably I'm going to end up just doing a really bad job out of an overabundance of caution." And he goes, "Well, you know, the thing is, if you don't care about the quality of the outcome, it's quite okay. Whatever happens, happens. So if your attitude is, if you want to make me an honorary Devo member, as long as you don't care about the quality of the outcome, I can happily step in."
Because I wouldn't undersell yourself.
Well, see. It's a leap of faith on your part, but I will happily send you some examples of the kind of shenanigans that we're talking about, because it's been great fun, and it's one of those things that the audience, what I love is that they immediately get it. They understand, you know, oh, this thing over there happened because the player did that. And something that might seem really abstract, video games have made it so easy to understand. The whole notion of narrative that players have agency over is actually, we've got a few decades now of people coming to really understand that.
Yeah.
And it's exciting to hear. Obviously, in a game like Ratchet and Clank, the design is going to prescribe a lot of things for you, in the same way that, you know, if you're scoring a movie and there's an action scene, there's certain parameters that are kind of dictated to a degree because the film has needs, and so too does the game. But were there any experiments that you were able to engage in that felt novel on this particular one? The game's kind of overwhelming, so I wasn't necessarily able to pick up on those, but I'm curious because it sounds like you would be drawn to that.
You know, for us, it gave us a chance to really get to experiment with electronics added on to the orchestra. And we let, you know, we had themes within, you know, for characters and, for different levels. But it was just kind of nice to like play with, you know, like I found some software that I really liked. What's it called? Rubby, I can't remember the name of it. It's some like trash burn or something, or trash can
players. Like a plugin?
It was a plugin, and then we put it.
It's
with
not the. It's not the like dumpster fire.
That's it. Yeah, dumpster. And I didn't know about it before last year.
It's one of those plugins that you don't really know what it's going to do. It's just kind of mangles things into crazy ways.
And it just happened to be, it just added some interesting elements to everything for us. And, you know, it made everybody kind of think about, the electronic side different than they normally would. And that was fun.
Well, quasi-related, but there's this like musical theater number that shows up in the game. And I remember I heard it on the album, and then I was playing the game going, where the hell is this? I kept waiting for this musical number to kick in. And so I remember I was perusing on YouTube, and there was a lot of speculation that there was something that had been cut, but the music had basically been front-loaded. And at the risk of potentially asking you to speak out of turn with regard to NDAs, is there any validity to that? Is there anything that says like there was essentially a number that was being planned? What's kind of the, is there a story there? Am I asking things I shouldn't be asking about?
There's not that interesting a story, but it was a song we created, and then it got expanded on by our production team, and they had singers from around the world sing on it. And so there was different versions of it.
But was there a context? I guess I'm just curious, like, because it's just right now, it's just kind of parked in the end credits, but I was curious, it sounds like such a theatrical thing that I wondered if there was a gameplay set piece or a big cinematic or something that
You talking about a different song? You're not talking about Dr. Nefarious theme. You're talking about something else.
I am talking about that. Yeah. His kind of, it's like a, it's like a real musical number. And that's why it felt like there was a context that I was somehow missing, because it's just so, it's so over the top and delightful.
Oh, good. I'm glad you felt that way about it. But there's no big secrets behind it. It was like
it's just for the joy of creating music, I guess.
Yeah. It was just being inspired by the character and the plot line. So
that in a way, that's the best answer you could have given, because so often there are examples of like, oh, we had to cut that scene, or oh, we had to, you know, trim that thing back, or whatever, and so you end up with these little musical relics of earlier incarnations of an unfinished product. And I wasn't sure if this was one of those, and I was, you know, slightly gun shy to ask about it in case it was one of those, you know, things that an NDA would be upset about, or worse, is like this heartbreaking, oh, you know, we had this whole plan. And but it's actually my favorite answer, that just, no, we were having fun, basically.
Yeah, this was a pretty healthy, it was just a great experience working with these people. I've known some of them for a while, and some of them I just got to know. And it was impressive how knowledgeable they were about music and how much they'd thought about it. And, you know, they gave us a lot of leeway, and it was a pretty great experience working on this project.
Had you worked with Insomniac before?
Some of them, I think, were part of Naughty Dog. Is that correct? And that's how I knew.
Maybe. I mean, you know, the Sony family of studios certainly has some internal movement. So that I'm sure. Yes. So
I did Jack and Daxter and other ones. I can't even think of the name at the top of my head, but I did other games back in the day with some of those people.
Yeah. Well, the results are just—it's so tremendously kinetic, and I'm so thrilled to hear that the combination of the world going into lockdown and your own just horrendous experience that you had to endure didn't screw with what you were delivering, because the results are superb.
You know, it kind of maybe gave us a little extra time too. So it's like it gave everybody, including them, time to think about the project more this last year, you know, because as things slowed down, you know, your mind doesn't stop working and you still keep thinking of things. And so I think the game benefited from it.
Well, it's a hell of a, of all the games so far on, you know, PS5, to me, it probably is the single strongest selling point for the console to date, because it's just the sheer artistry that Insomniac brought to it is unreal.
Goal.
we've sold some PlayStations. Well, I don't want to be too abusive of your time. I'm really grateful that you've let me kind of dig into this pretty disparate group of subjects.
I hope there's something useful here for you.
Oh, this is going to be unvarnished, man. We hit go and then it's over when it's over. And so there's no, this is not trimmed. This is not transcribed. This is just listen to the download of the Mark Mothersbaugh brain machine for an hour and a half. And I think that it will give everyone exactly what they're looking for. So no, I can't thank you enough. I'm sure you're very busy. I know you're working on your vocal cords. And I don't want to, like I said, to be abusive of your generosity.
Yeah. I got to work on that, getting up there high enough in pitch. I got to be able to sing like I was 22 again, see?
Well, you know, I hope that the axiom of where there's a will, there's a way turns out to be true in this case. Because
I'm thinking optimistically.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Best of luck. It does sound like a genuinely good outlook, like a positive outlook, on a thing that would probably actually chew up and spit out most people, because, you know, it's actually a really horribly shitty thing that you had to go through that this is a kind of byproduct of. And so it's nice to hear the, you know, just kind of rolling with the punches.
Hey, well, I've never been sick before. It was an interesting experience.
Well, that's a hell of a statement to be able to make. So that's, I'm thrilled you made it that long without having to endure anything like that, even if it's awful to, you know, have gone through it. But it, to me, in a way, I mean, it's easy for me to say having not gone through it, but it all sounds worth it for that wonderful little father-daughter coffee pouring story. It's almost like in some perverse sense, it was justified by that.
Well, I'm with you on that. I look for silver linings whenever you can, you know. I'm an optimist at heart.
Yeah. A disciple of Timothy Leary. It's so funny. That's a connection I didn't know about. So, thank you so much for agreeing to do this, and congrats on the great work. I'm glad that the health has found you well, and hopefully we'll hear some more games with your stuff in it sooner than later.
I hope so too. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.
The Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences is excited to share that the 2022 DICE Summit and DICE Awards will be returning in person to the gorgeous Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino and Delano Hotel in Las Vegas on February 22nd to 24th, 2022. We'll be celebrating the 25th anniversary of the DICE Awards and bringing together industry leaders to share their ideas about the many facets of the interactive entertainment industry. Stay tuned to www.interactive.org and our Twitter, @official_AIAS, for more details coming soon, including special anniversary rates. We can't wait to see you again.